I'm going to introduce you to Andy Anides. There are amazing people in this world, and they're very amazing people. And Andy, like some of the others you've seen today, is also very amazing. I was on a sabbatical in California, and I came across a machine which measured magnetic fields, and there was only one of them in America, or two, and they had just one channel. That means you just got the fields from one place. It was very high tech. It required liquid helium to make it work, and it included SQUIDs in it, superconducting quantum interference devices. And the thing about magnetic fields is they go through the brain, the skull, and the scalp without being altered. And so if they really do that, then you should be able to see deep into the brain using magnetic fields. Now, when I came back to the UK, I was all fired up. And I talked to people about this, and they all said, no, just do EEG. But EEG is attenuated, and it's distorted. And I then found a SQUID unit up at the Open University, Milton Keynes, and it was run by a guy called Steve Swithenby. And he got one channel, just like in America, and he was measuring potentials of the muscles in the leg. And I said, no, Steve, it's the brain we want to do. And he said, no, that's far too complex. So there was, in fact, a conference there where I met Andy. And Andy's use of magnetic fields are second to none in the world. And he will tell you more about what he achieved. And I was so pleased to be part of it. But we could actually see the deeper structures of the brain in action, millisecond by millisecond. It is the most wonderful machine. So, Andy, come along.
Thank you, Peter. It's really wonderful to be here. It's an august occasion. It's a fun occasion. Last night, I changed off my talks. I removed all the results, all the references and everything, because I thought that should not be about the results. I could talk about one result for 2 hours. To talk about all of our results in this time, it would be impossible. So this is going to be a journey into the past, a journey into science, by two people who always were young at heart. I'm accused of being young at heart. I don't need to tell you how young at heart Peter is, right? He's not just an optimist. He not only looks at the bright side of life, but he's always looking at an idea as a child, with the wonder of a child. And that we share. And that's why we had a huge pleasure together. So the time with Peter is like a film. This is from a goodbye, a farewell party that we gave to Peter in Japan, not in England, when he came for the first time as an emeritus visitor. And, of course, I said to him at that time, we will see you again. And we did see you again many times in Japan, and more recently in Cyprus, where I now reside. So my life with Peter and Elizabeth, the science we share, it was always a science with pleasure and fun, like in a film, but it was also a family time. Peter was there when my son Kostas gave his performance in Leighton Buzzard in a performance of Greece. And ever since, he sends with like all the family then greetings to both of you. And in every time in our lives, Peter and Elizabeth were there, not just as friends, but also some family. And so, you know, I really feel that I'm within one big family here because we share a lot of good sense and a lot of times together. And that's why in these images there are families. Now, what you see in the picture here is not a hairdresser's thing. It's what Peter described, but it's a modern instrument. It's a modern instrument which has liquid helium. It's like a big thermos flux. It doesn't have wine or beer, but it has liquid helium because you need to detect tiny, tiny magnetic fields from the head. And this is done through coils, which are pretty close to the head. And the important thing is you can sample all this from, say, hundreds of channels like that in a fraction of a second. Actually, you can sample it 1,000 times every second. And because the speed of propagation from the source to the sensors is the speed of light, you can actually have independent measurements thousands times a second. Now, that is important. It's important because it means you can actually sample at frequencies which are good enough to see how the information flows in the brain. So if you want to criticize the reductionist approach, you have to understand the reductionist approach in the language that can be understood. And with Peter, we do criticize the reductionist approach. We share a lot of things in that way. But you want to understand the limits of what this technology can give us. And that machine can do it. But when I met Peter, there were no machines like that. There were nothing with many, many channels. As Peter mentioned, it was just a single channel. So people were having to repeat the measurement many times around the head in order to get one map, to get one idea about what was happening in the brain. And people could only see things which were close to the surface of the head. And they interpret that, they were physicists, in terms of physics. Totally wrong. That was not there was no reason why we couldn't see it deeper, but because of the way the experiment had to be done, we could only sense the superficial sources. That's too technical. Ask me questions at the end if you're more interested about that. And in this conference that Peter mentioned at Milton Keynes, I was just starting there. I was a nuclear physicist in my first life, and I was deciding to change into something new. And yes, you're right. Peter Swedenby was looking at the currents in the leg, and they was approximated that by two infinite wires. And I said to the PhD, the postdoctoral fellow that I was sharing the room with, why do you have this ridiculous model? Tell me there is no unique solution. That immediately teased me because I was working on a non-unique problem in nuclear physics. And I looked at the mathematics, and I realized that there was a solution. But everybody was talking about doing things with dipoles, putting point sources in the brain. And then Peter gives his invited paper. His title was The Inverse Problem, A Medical Perspective. But what he really talked about was something different. What he talked about is what MEG must do in order to become relevant to neuroscience and medicine. So I heard many talks from physicists, from eminent doctors. They did not make sense to me. I realized that they really did not understand what the essence of what they were talking is, but here was a person who was actually saying something which was very true. It was a vision of the future that people today that with these instruments only now begin to understand. But he had the vision. And I was proud to be part of shaping that distance, but what was the message that he really said? What he said is that the central message is that dig deep. You have to go deep in the brain to understand the brain. You cannot just look at the surface. Especially in psychiatry, everything happens deep down. And the second thing that he said is you have to look everywhere. And you have to look everywhere in an instance. In other words, you have to be able to flow with the information. The brain without dynamics, function of the brain without dynamics is meaningless. But I have to clarify, he did not mean the kind of hole that you see many scientists do. Dig deep and bury yourself in a hole. He meant look deep from above and everywhere at once, like you look from a satellite. And I had the vision that was feasible. So at the end of the talk, that of course was absolutely impossible for physicists at the time, but fortunately not for all of them. I felt it could be done. So at the end of the talk, I went to Peter, I said to him, I didn't call you Peter then. Dr. Fennick? No, I was. I think I can do everything that you say in 3 months. You know what he did? He turned around and said, oh, call me in 3 months. He left. That's what you say, the rest is history. 3 months later, no, I say 6 months, and in 3 months I call you. And 3 months later I called him, I said, look, I've done it. Would you like to know more about it? He says, okay, come back to Mosley. So I went to Mosley. I waited from some TV crew to get an interview for a couple of hours. We had a chat, and then every other week, every 2 weeks, we were in each other's lap talking about it. And for the next few years, there was no MEG in England at the time, at least none with many channels. We were writing letters to the best laboratories in the world, and we were going first close by to Germany to do experiments. There. Then a little bit further away, San Diego, Vancouver, getting the data back to our PhD students to analyze. Eventually, Europe was not enough for us, so he said, why don't you go to Japan? I followed through. No, not really. So I went to Japan, and he was there for much of the time, on and off. And we've done some wonderful work together. I will not talk about that, but I would just want to give a glimpse of what we really achieved. What has been achieved in the last years was indeed to dig deeper. We were able to see, first of all, at the surface of the head, and again, Peter always wanted to go at the deep structures, the thalamus and the like. I said, no, nobody believes we have the resolution. Let's look at the surface first. We convinced people that we actually had the resolution to look very precisely at the surface of the brain. And again, I will talk about what I mean by more precisely, because this is very important. It means we had the right tools to do the timing and the geography of the brain. We could look at the areas which we must distinguish in order to understand what is happening in the brain. And we could look everywhere and describe what we see in a unified framework, a modern fashion, this connectomics that you see right now. We probably start the first connectomics with MEG by looking at how two areas with the CMV experiment relate to each other. And we could look at an instance, every instance, across very different spatial and temporal domains, which means we could see that the brain is not like a ball that you kick and move. It's not a mechanistic system like that. Every time you do an experiment, every time you see an identical simple stimulus, it responds in a different way. And we had paper after paper, fighting with the request to publish. And eventually, the idea became accepted. Now you have the resting state as one of the dominant ways of thinking about the brain, namely that the brain is never silent. It's always active, and you can actually get information from what the subject is doing when it's not doing anything, but his brain is still working. We pushed this idea with Peter a lot further by doing some of the first experiments to study the brain in sleep, the first experiments with MEG, colonized sleep. And that's another story which we're very excited, and we're getting results which even today are becoming very relevant. So let me tell you what this work with Peter has achieved. We partition different modalities in terms of the spatial resolution. What do you see? Do you see molecules? Do you see brain areas? Do you see the whole of the brain? So this dimension going vertically up is the spatial dimension, and how short you see in time. So this is in the region of seconds. Now go down to milliseconds here, or minutes and hours. So the various techniques like PET, you can look over minutes. fMRI, you can look over seconds. People believe, and some people still believe, use this kind of diagram, that EEG and MEG is at this level here. So you can look at things in the order of milliseconds. You have the temporal resolution. You can see how activity changes as one area is activated and then another one takes over. But what we have shown with Peter is that the true change with MEG is that we can actually go down in resolution, be as good or even better as most fMRI studies. In other words, with the same modality, we can look into the brain within cytoarchitectonic areas, the geographically distinct areas with two different functions, and we can look at the way the activity goes on. The challenge right now is how to put this in the brain. So this is what we've done with Peter, but let me share some pictures to just remember some of the times. This was Peter at Riken, when we first started, and we just have more or less empty space, not even the MEG, right? The MEG was built at the time, but we had data, the data we collected all over the world to analyze at the time. And this is at another farewell party, not Peter's. Peter Consis, this guy here, who came to do an experiment with Kanitsa triangles, illusory contours. And we had a reunion party, and then we had the family across. Right? I could never convince Teresa to go into the lab. The other thing, or his children, but the other thing that Peter was very good, which it was not emphasized today, and I want to actually emphasize very strongly, he's a fantastic communicator and kind to everybody. I am the kind of person that I won the results yesterday. So it was very nice to have in the team somebody who had the patience with Peter and Elizabeth to actually say, you know, this crazy Cypriot is like that, but it's okay, it's good at heart. And then take them by the hand and actually coach them through. It was really like a family. And also when you had visitors like in this group evaluation at Riken, of course Peter was there to explain things together with everybody else, and it was a real feeling of a team actually working. And it was always a family occasion, right? We share each other's pleasure. His grandchildren were, you know, part of our family. My children were definitely part of Peter's family. And even when we were subjecting children to MEG experiments, it's not bad. It's really, really very nice. It's completely non-invasive, no contact. We had somebody to cool them down, to always smile before they actually go to sleep in the MEG unit. Remember this figure? Oh, somebody says. I actually was talking to some friends in Cyprus over the phone and saying, I'm doing experiments with my children and I'm asleep. And they were horrified. They said, you mean you treat your children like guinea pigs? I said, no. Another fallacy of science, you know, in the way this society works. I could never convince Trish to put his son into the machine. Shame. Did Peter ever let the team down? So last night, after a lot of wines, when I went back, I wanted to put a slide with something negative. And I said, what did Peter do to let the team down? Now, I love basketball. Okay. I had a tremendous outside shot. And even until recently, I used to play. So I wanted somebody tall in the team. We had any tall person, Japanese people are small. I could never convince Peter to come and play with us. He would walk, he would do all the exercise, everything, but not basketball. But of course, we had a wonderful time. That's Sakurai. Of course, we've done experiments about single trials to see how things play with Elizabeth. Right, in the Garden of Eden. And finally, I want to send some messages from people who are not here with us now. George Kostopoulos, my family sent the greetings already, so I'm not going to repeat them. But George Kostopoulos sent me an email late last night, which I thought I have to put in. Dear Andreas, please give my best wishes to Peter. I attached three photos I found. In one of them, it poses in front of Mount Fuji. Do you remember where is this from? From the central building. And another message for Peter. You promised George that you'd do another climbing. You went to Mount Fuji. You tried to convince me to come along. I didn't, thankfully, because he got lost, right? For about 6 hours. We're wondering what happened to him. And then he convinced my wife to go. I refused to go, and she came back, and she couldn't work for 2 weeks. But you promised George that you're going to climb the throne of Zeus. So he wants to keep you up there. I don't know whether you know. But if you want to go there, I will come with you this time. Now, I don't know how wide this might be, but I personally want to invite you and Elizabeth to a new quest, because you asked me to do studies on consciousness for the last 20 years, and I said, no, it's too early. I like what you're doing. I like these thoughts, you know, the network and everything else. But I thought that the first thing we had to do is to prove our credentials in the scientific world, that we had a machine which wonderfully can do all these things. It can see inside the brain. How far can we push that? We've done that. Now we are ready for the next step. So we may not go to the throne of Zeus, but we can go to the mind of Zeus, consciousness. So in the next 10 years, let this be our goal, Peter. Finally, thanks for the people closest to us. John Taylor left us rather early. Vahe and Lichan have been co-travelers in this wonderful journey. And of course, the twins who expect the book. And thank you very much. It has really been a fun journey, and I promise you the best is still to come. Thank you.
Absolutely amazing. When Andy first came up to me and said that he could, in fact, show me the brain in action, it was clearly rubbish. Nobody else could. And nobody can now, except really him and the techniques that he's created. And there you can look at the brain functioning millisecond by millisecond, or even thirds of a millisecond. And so, as Andy said, one of the things we learned was that when you put a stimulus into the brain reacts differently each time you put it in. Now, if you go to the MRIs, because they average a whole lot of these things and are very slow, they appear to put functions in different places. In actual fact, the brain doesn't work like that. So, Andy, let me say thank you very much for everything. Brilliant. If anybody can deliver, Andy can.